Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Let's get the hour underway with a new addition to Eastern Standard in our roster of series. Hosted by Dr. Lee Todd, former president of the University of Kentucky, this series will highlight the connections between education and economy, with special emphasis on a third E, entrepreneurship. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Todd.
Glad to be here, Tom.
And let's get a little bit of history first. Where is home? Where did you grow up in Kentucky?
I grew up in Arlington, Kentucky. It's down in western Kentucky near Madisonville in Hopkins County, and population about 2,000 people at that time. Went through all 12 grades there in Arlington. It was a great place to grow up.
And where'd you go to school?
I went to Murray. None of my family members had ever gone to college, and Murray was the closest one to Arlington. So I went to Murray my first 2 years and studied pre-engineering, and then to UK to do my electrical engineering degree. And I was very fortunate when I was a senior at UK, I was interviewed by Dr. Edward Teller, who was the father of the hydrogen bomb and did a lot of other things in physics. But as a result of that, he got me a full fellowship to attend MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, from the John and Fannie Hertz Foundation Corporation, which he was associated with. So MIT was where I got my master's and doctorate.
And so you came back to Kentucky from there. What brought you back here?
Well, Patsy and I both grew up in Arlington. We started first grade together. And, you know, Happy Chandler always said he never met a Kentuckian who wasn't coming home. And I think that that was us, too. The only job I could have had in Kentucky at that time was at the university. Unfortunately, there was a job opening there. And I, too, had felt that I'd been blessed to get an education that I never expected to have, and that I'd like to come back and see if I could use it to improve the home state of Kentucky.
So UK, MIT, what are the differences between those two institutions?
Well, MIT, I got to have a lot of professors who had started their own companies. The one I knew best was Amar Bose, who had started his Bose speaker company. The environment around the institute was very entrepreneurial. A lot of startup companies and a lot of very high quality jobs. Those are the main things. It struck me that when I came back to UK and started talking to students, and they'd ask me, you know, what are some differences? The thing that hit me, I said, if you walk through the student lounge on Monday morning, they're not talking about basketball. You know, they're talking about doing something to shift the world slightly. And they didn't go to MIT expecting to work for somebody else all their lives. Many of our students, you know, go to college to get a job, and they up there go to college to create jobs. And that's been kind of a mainstay for me throughout my time here in Kentucky, is try to get us to realize that we can start our own companies and we can be competitive. So that was one of the big differences. It's taken a while to get that environment up to speed here, and it's moving and making some progress.
Well, now, I know that you actually taught at UK. You were a professor there, and you left UK after about 9 years. Why did you leave?
Well, a couple of reasons. I love teaching. I could have had my whole career just teaching at UK. But for one thing, I had gotten 6 patents when I was at MIT, and I had licensed them to a company in Boston, but they ended up in 1983, during the recession, they went bankrupt. And I had to make a choice. Do I want to just let the thing die, or do I want to try to keep this concept going with these patents, which was an area of large screen displays with very high resolution? This was back in the early 80s. And so I decided to go ahead and buy the equipment and leave the university. One of the reasons, or the two reasons, one is that we had a new dean to come in, and he called me to the office one time because he was bothered by the fact. He said, how do you think you can be a professor here and still have a company? And I said, well, sir, if I was still at MIT and I didn't have a company, they'd be calling me to their office saying, why aren't you doing something that's, you know, beneficial to the country? And said, if I can't do both, I'll leave, because I think it's important for us to demonstrate that this university has the ability to grow companies. But the other reason that was very important to me was that the last year I taught at UK, 80% of the electrical engineering students left the state of Kentucky to find jobs. And those are really our best and brightest. when we lose them, we lose their children and their children's children because they grew up elsewhere. And I had seen so many of them leave UK and go elsewhere that I knew I had the talent here in this area that I could use that talent to build a company. And that's what we did. So I left for a couple of reasons. One, I just didn't feel comfortable, you know, having a company and being on the faculty. But secondly, I thought I had the firepower with the intellectual people that we had at the university to start some companies. So I started two.
Well, you know, following up on what you just said, the Council on Postsecondary Education in Frankfurt is just out with an analysis that projects that engineering jobs will increase more than 11% in Kentucky by 2029, which would be even higher than the national average, which is about 10.8%. And so that would seem to drive the need for more college degrees in engineering.
Absolutely. You know, there are two things that can help build our economy. One is that we can start our own companies, and that has been going on and hopefully moving further ahead. But secondly, if we're going to attract companies to come here that are going to really need the talent to compete internationally, we've got to have strong engineering students that can join those companies. And so it's interesting that that report just came out because last year it was pointed out that aerospace was the largest exporter for goods from Kentucky. And so many people just don't know that that's happening in this state. Those are very good paying jobs, you know, full benefits, $60,000, $70,000 starting out. And I will also say that there are a lot of women going through engineering schools now that are finding some extremely attractive jobs. So that's good to hear. We've got to meet that need.
You became very involved in an advocacy role in STEM education and encouraging high-tech economic development. Why did you do that?
Well, it's my feeling that if we're going to be competitive, I knew that a lot of the cut-and-sew jobs we had were going to go away. The call center jobs were going to go away. The world just got so flat that those jobs would move to very low labor cost countries. And we had to be more competitive. And in order to do that, we had to build a more skilled base and a more entrepreneurial environment. And one of the things that I was able to do was to be on Lieutenant Governor Steve Beshear's Kentucky Tomorrow Commission and met Chris Kimmel, who was his main person that put that effort in place. They asked me to chair the technology committee. They had several committees looking at the future of Kentucky. We worked on that for about a year and a half, and Steve did not get elected governor, but Chris and I felt that report was too strong that we wanted to make it go. So we started the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation, and the emphasis there was on improving hands-on STEM education in Kentucky and improving university research so that we can be generating our own ideas within the state. And then finally, changing the economy to make it more friendly toward people who started companies here, that we didn't just have to recruit companies and give them money to come here for cheap land and cheap labor, that we needed to help our own people start their own businesses. And so I spent quite a bit of time before I even interviewed for the UK job. I told the search committee that I'd given 88 speeches in Kentucky to anybody that would listen, talking about improving education and changing the economic development environment. So that's something I had a real passion for. Spent a fair amount of time on it.
There's been concern that a focus on and investment in science, technology, engineering, and math might come at the expense of the humanities and the arts. How do you address those concerns?
That's just not going to be the case. Today, more than any other time in our history, people need to have a much broader education. With my company, I traveled a lot. I'd be in Singapore or in England, Germany. The people there that I was trying to do business with knew a whole lot more about our country than we knew about them. And it makes a difference if you have the ability to be knowledgeable about the world. I always encourage students to take some foreign languages so that they can be more comfortable and show some respect for the countries that they work with. And we have to have some skills that are just not technical skills. I was on a committee once with the vice president of Boeing, who's in charge of hiring people. And he said, you know, I've never fired an engineer because they couldn't do engineering. But I fired a lot of engineers who couldn't get along with people, who couldn't plan a schedule, who couldn't write, who couldn't communicate. And he said, I think this thing we used to call soft skills is really the harder skills of this era. Mm-hmm. And students need to be critical thinkers. They need to be good communicators. And so I think it's very wrong to try to segment education into technical and non-technical. When I started my company, I had 8 people on staff that were English majors. They were writing our documents and so forth. And you have to have accountants and bookkeepers. So we need all the people. The key is just to get educated in something you have a passion for. And the arts are vital. Patsy and I were very active in the arts, partly because our daughter was a performer for a long time. But you have to have a rounded community. You'll find if you want to bring people to this state, they want their child to be able to take ballet lessons. They want them to be able to, you know, be in an environment that has the arts. And so we have to build a full state. We can't take a short route and just try to do one thing. We'll come up short.
Well, eventually you transitioned from the business world to the academic world and became president of the University of Kentucky. How did that happen?
You know, I had 2 companies for 18 years. I sold one to Hughes Aircraft, and I got Hughes to move to Kentucky, one of their divisions, and start the Coldstream Research Campus. And I ran that building for a while. And I also sold DataBeam to IBM, and I became vice president of Lotus, their software division. They left most of our engineers and software developers here in Lexington, so I was very proud of that. So I was the vice president of Lotus when Dr. Weddington announced that he was going to retire. I got something in the mail that someone had nominated me for that position, but I just couldn't envision myself being president of the UK. It's coming up from where I grew up, I didn't think I'd ever go to UK. And, you know, we have such a self-esteem issue in Kentucky. We think there are things that we can't do. So it took me a while to convince myself, and my wife was a major factor there, that I should apply for the position. And so I did, and what finally came to me was that presidency of UK is probably the best position in the state to have an impact in the state. You're not politically appointed. You don't have a 4-year term. You know, you don't have to do anything but focus on the things that will help change the state. So I applied, and it was the greatest honor of my life to get that position.
Just before you became president of UK, then-Governor Paul Patton challenged the university to become a top 20 public research university. I wonder how that challenge affected your decision to go ahead and apply for the UK position.
That was probably the other thing that tipped me over, because I think that was one of the best challenges that had been issued for higher education ever in the state of Kentucky. Governor Patton realized that we had to be competitive and we needed research universities in order to do that. And I realized a lot of people weren't believers in that, and it's a hard thing to do because, for one thing, the people that are in the top 20 don't want to leave, and they've got a history of funding that they can keep going easier than you can if you have to start from scratch or from low number of dollars. But I took it as a challenge, and I'd have to say that when I first went on campus after it was announced I'd be president, there was a lot of eye rolling when we were talking about top 20. But eventually we got around to the fact that it was a responsibility that we had to tell the state government what we needed to do, how much we needed to do, and what we would do with the money. I decided to write a business plan. When I raised money for my companies, and I had to raise money because they weren't cheap things, we put a lot of money into salaries for these bright young kids, and it wasn't your usual construction business that you could sell a product. It was really risky. But every time I had to raise money, I had to write a business plan. And we need to write a top 20 business plan for the university. There are a lot of people on campus that didn't first like that idea, but we got very firm backing from the legislature. They gave us a $26 or $29 million base increase in our biennial funding. And we had a path, and I think they would have stayed on it, except here comes 2008, and it just took the money out of the vocabulary with the recession that hit. But with the initial funding they gave us, we were able to bring on some very attractive candidates that are still there, and we began doing some things to push forward in going after the NCI designation that the Markey Cancer Center now has, and, you know, building a research empire that could touch the areas of the economy here in Kentucky that we felt would help the state grow. So I thought it was a great challenge, and I was very pleased that, that it was on our back.
Well, what would you say makes your short list of accomplishments during your term of service at UK?
Well, there's several things that I'm proud of, more than I could probably say. But I think, for one thing, you know, we increased the research level, which was around $160 million. And now at UK, it's about $400 million. So it's more than doubled. But philosophically, UK is really tackling the problems of Kentucky. When I gave my inaugural address, I mentioned that we could become top 20 in just measuring research dollars by doing what the federal government or corporations want us to do. They could tell us what to do, we would do it, and they'd give us some money, and we'd move up the ladder. But we could fail the state of Kentucky, that we needed to be, as a land-grant university, working on the problems of Kentucky. And I refer to those problems to as the Kentucky uglies, that we've been living with, you know, lung cancer and spina bifida and obesity and things that are very much kind of assumed that we're just going to be that way, and that we need to use our best minds to work on those toughest problems. And they've really done that. They just opened a new building, about a $250 million building, to focus on addressing Kentucky problems. So that was a philosophical change in just how we looked at what we were responsible for as a university. We built a new hospital, which I hope many have seen. I hope that it, you know, gets back to function and gets a critical piece for things like we're going through right now. But we also encouraged a lot of entrepreneurship, not only from our faculty, but our staff and students. I started an entrepreneurship club that I chaired for a student body to get them to think about entrepreneurship. And, of course, everybody thinks about athletics. I made some significant hires in athletics, but in addition, with Mitch Barnhart coming here, we got all the athletic programs competitive, not just football and basketball. And I'm proud to say that we've not had an NCAA investigation now for 19 years, which is the longest period of time in UK's history to not have some issue there. So bottom line of, I think, the accomplishment was that we changed the attitude of the place. We got people to really think about what we needed to do with creating companies, solving Kentucky problems, and having a real clean, competitive athletic department.
So you're retired now.
I am, yeah.
So besides doing this series on Eastern Standard, how are you spending your time these days?
Well, we have our first grandchild, and so we haven't seen her now for about 2 weeks because of the virus, but we will for sure do that. Doing a lot of yard work. I love working out in the yard. Patch and I travel quite a bit. On the business side, I'm on the board of a startup company called Space Tango here in town, started by a UK student when I was president. I'm on the Breathe board. Breathe is an organization that is focusing on creating tobacco-free environments here in Kentucky. UK was the first major university to go tobacco-free in the country, and I'm proud of that, so I serve on that committee. And I'm toying with, you know, writing a book. I give speeches when I'm asked, but with all that, I'm reading a lot and enjoying life, but trying to stay active and trying to relax some.
So, Dr. Todd, briefly, if you could tell us, what can we look forward to hearing in this series, and what do you hope to accomplish by sharing the information with our listeners?
Well, for one thing, I'm really excited that you asked me to do this. I think what I'd like to do is talk about how we can strengthen the state of Kentucky to make us more competitive. You know, it involves education, and we'll be bringing on some guest speakers that are talking about creating P-12 hands-on science and engineering type curriculums, and in order to get our children to be more interested in the math science area. We'll be interviewing some teachers from Eastern Kentucky and some students as well. We'll look at research. There's some areas of research like aerospace, pharmaceuticals, and energy that are going on that a lot of people don't know, and I'm going to have some research faculty as well as some corporate researchers come on and talk about that. And then in economic development, talk about not only the people who have started companies and have some of those entrepreneurs on the program, but also some venture capitalists and people who make the investments. And one of those would be from the Eastern Kentucky area as well. I think the bottom line is what I like to do is just to continue to tell people in this state that we can compete. Kentuckians can compete in a variety of ways. We've got the talent. We've just got to cultivate that talent and give them the opportunity to compete, and they will do so and help change the state.
Former University of Kentucky President Lee Todd, he is the new host of a new Eastern Standard series on economic development, education, and entrepreneurship in Kentucky. We're looking forward to it, Dr. Todd.
So am I. Thanks, Tom.
WEKU is now providing a daily 10-minute coronavirus update hosted by Kelly McEvers. NPR's Coronavirus Daily podcast is available at weku.org. Just look for the blue coronavirus link and click the Listen Now tab to hear the latest. Coming up after the break, part two of a history of the Maxey Flats nuclear waste disposal site near Moorhead.
When you look back at this history, the importance of just on-the-ground journalism, it really helped break this story. It helped validate the concerns that people had in the community. It gave them finally some information that they needed and that they couldn't get access to.
From my perspective as a scientist and an engineer, from what I've seen that has been proposed at the site, it looks like that they finally got some good solutions in place.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Last week, we brought you part one of a history of the Maxey Flats nuclear waste dump near Moorhead. In part one, we learned that nearly 5 million cubic feet of all sorts of radioactive waste, including plutonium and enriched uranium, is stored at the site, and for many years in unlined trenches that had a tendency to leak into the surrounding environment. Now, part two of my conversation with University of Memphis historian Carolyn Payton, author of Kentucky's Atomic Graveyard, Maxey Flats, and Environmental Inequity in Rural America. It's published by the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society. The Environmental Protection Agency published a study of Maxey Flats in 1976, and you say it was alarming. What was in that report?
The 76 report was extremely alarming. And I think, you know, number one, it was alarming for the community. This validated in some ways some of their suspicions. And you had already had at that point for a few years, you had pretty steady local coverage of what was happening at Maxey Flats as well. And I think that's before getting to the EPA report, I do want to mention that because I think when you look back at this history, the importance of just on the ground journalism, it really helped break this story. It helped validate the concerns that people had in the community. It gave them finally some information that they needed and that they couldn't get access to. And then the EPA finally confirmed more of this. But what the report revealed was that the radioactive isotopes of plutonium had left the trenches and were possibly moving far beyond the site's confines. And this was especially concerning because they started to realize that perhaps, well, plutonium doesn't move simply, you know, a few centimeters in a lifetime. Perhaps it could move much further. And so some of the environmental risks of burial became abundantly clear. And so this not only confirmed the migration of plutonium, but it also revealed that maybe it was in fact had moved through these deep layers of shale in a way that, again, people didn't anticipate when the site was first licensed.
You write about some individuals, and one of them was a fellow by the name of Bobby Wilson. Who was Bobby Wilson?
Bobby Wilson was a whistleblower, and it's funny because I didn't actually describe him as a whistleblower in my article, but reflecting upon it further, I'm like, of course he was a whistleblower. So Bobby Wilson was a former employee of the state's Radiation Bureau, and he alleged over a period of 8 years that he had witnessed numerous violations at Maxey Flats, which regulators who were supposed to monitor the site either didn't report or they had ignored. And so among those violations, they noticed a bathtub effect occurring in the trenches, which means that water, not surprisingly, given all of the rainfall in this area, had accumulated. And this provided a perfect vehicle for those radioactive isotopes to leave the trenches. And so they didn't intervene. And they also didn't intervene when the company, the nuclear engineering company, was using evaporators to try to remove some of that water, but they were also releasing radiation in the process. And so he's an important figure in the story because he was, you know, really an insider who also made public the fact that people had realized that the site was being mismanaged and that there were a number of violations and no one was coming forward to actually intervene with that mismanagement.
So what finally led to the site's closure in the late 70s and then its transfer to the Commonwealth of Kentucky?
So I think a number of factors led to the site's eventual closure. And one of those, I mean, not only does the EPA's revelations, I think, put a lot of political pressure on, particularly on Governor Julian Carroll to act. I mean, that was one aspect of this. The situation had become more urgent because of all of these reports that were coming out about the migration of radionuclides. But also you had a lot of activism from the community. And so in the mid-1970s, people within the community will form the Maxey Flats Protective Association. And this was led by John P. Hay, who was a kind of lifelong resident of the area. He was somebody who had a real connection to the land, and he had long suspected that their practices, the company's practices, were not what they claimed to be. And, you know, part of this was merely from observation. And there were other people in the community who had noticed changes in, you know, the color of streams in the area or discoloration. They had started to make connections between the company's practices and other developments, particularly on their land. And so the community's activism as well, I think, added to that political pressure. And so by 1977, the situation had become much more urgent because it was also revealed that those radionuclides had started moving deep within the subsurface of the site. And why that was a problem is once those radionuclides start moving deeper through those layers of shale and so forth as well, you don't entirely know where they're going to go. And this means that you have a very serious environmental problem on your hands. And so they initially tried to at least raise the fees per cubic foot to 10 cents from 5 cents, but it quickly became apparent that the state was, or the Commonwealth of Kentucky was going to have to take control of the site. And so they end up paying over $1 million, $1.25 million for control of the site. And so the costs are really incredible considering that over the site's lifetime, based on my calculations, they received maybe only somewhere around $136,000 in revenue, in tax revenue from Maxey Flats.
Total?
Yes, over roughly a decade of its operation. So perhaps it was higher by the, you know, by 77.
So fast forward just a bit into the mid 80s, Maxey Flats was declared a Superfund site. What happened then?
Well, so I've described the history of Maxey Flats as a slow moving environmental catastrophe. And even after it's designated a Superfund site and added to the national priorities list in the mid 1980s, it took quite some time for it to actually undergo the process of remediation. And so one of the pivot points in terms of getting some sort of action to happen immediately was that you still had, not only did you have over 2 million gallons of water that was still contained in the trenches, but also the site had become an imminent risk per the EPA when you had, you had these 20,000 gallon tanks. You had a number of them, and they were storing radioactive liquid. They had been in a building that wasn't climate controlled. There had already been thousands of gallons of radioactive liquid that had spilled. And so Kentucky officials, the potentially responsible parties that were named, you know, through the Superfund agreement, didn't want to bear the costs of cleaning it up. And so the EPA had to step in. And so you have your record of decision by the EPA in 91. And, you know, slowly over the course of the 90s and moving forward, you do have environmental remediation begin on the site, but it's a slow process. And part of the reason for that is because, you know, you had a lot of wrangling over who was actually going to pay for the cleanup. And so there was a real reluctance, I think, to take responsibility for what had actually happened, despite it going onto the national priorities list. There were a number of parties involved in this, but I think also the costs. There was, based on the documentary evidence that I could come across, that seemed to be at the forefront of people's minds.
Okay, let's fast forward all the way to now, 2020. Is the site stabilized?
I would characterize it as stabilized, yes. Based on everything that I have been able to learn from the EPA's documentation of it, I would consider the site to be stable, and they've finished adding the final capping layer of soil and synthetic materials, essentially to contain any of those dangers that the site would have posed in terms of radionuclide migration and so forth. It was a long process and a costly one at that, but it's still important to remember that even though the site is stable, it will require monitoring well into the next century. And so I think that's, the larger lesson of this. I mean, there are others wrapped up in this story as well, but is that even once the site was remediated at tremendous cost, and of course, cost to the community that has to live with Maxey Flats, there's still a century at least of monitoring that has to occur.
You've drawn another lesson from this. What does Maxey Flats tell us about environmental inequity in rural America?
Well, I think one aspect of this history and the importance of Maxey Flats particularly is that it tells us about the environmental burdens that rural communities have essentially experienced, especially after, I would say, 1945. So over the last 60, 70 years or so, this has been, in many ways, the environmental inequities or environmental risks that rural communities have faced are, in some ways, there are a lot of commonalities between environmental hazards that other communities face. But because of that geographic isolation and because of the limited economic opportunities that rural communities have to navigate, they sometimes take on greater environmental risks than other communities do. And I think I've seen this, from studying the nuclear industry in the American South, is that whether it's a nuclear power plant or a nuclear waste site, a lot of these communities, they understood the risks to some extent, not in technical terms, but they also saw this as a lifeline. And so I think one of the lessons that the history of Maxey Flats can also teach us is the way that these communities have to navigate notions of risk and an economic development. And so sometimes I think outsiders have presented, it's really easy to present rural communities that might not have the official title of expert. They might assume that people don't fully understand the risks they're taking on, but I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. But I also think that Maxey Flats is a story about environmental inequity in the sense that these communities have a kind of terrible nuclear shadow to live with for quite some time. But they also, you know, in many ways, proved to be really effective environmental activists. You didn't have to have all of the technical jargon and know-how to band together as a community and to put political pressure on government officials to take action. And so I think that's another lesson we can take away from XEFLATS.
Carolyn Payton, an instructor in the Department of History at the University of Memphis. Dr. Payton researched and wrote an article about XEFLATS for the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society, and we thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for your time, Tom.
Dr. Lyndall Ormsby is a professor of civil engineering at the University of Kentucky and associate director of the UK Superfund Basic Research Program, as well as head of the program's Research Translation Corps. Dr. Ormsby's additional appointments include executive director of the Tracy Farmer Institute for Sustainability and the Environment, director of the Kentucky Center of Excellence for Watershed Management, and director of the Kentucky Water Resources Research Institute. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Ormsby.
My pleasure, Tom.
And so first let me ask you, what was your involvement with XEFLATS?
Back in the mid-90s, as the state was discovering some serious environmental sites across the state, several of those sites were put on something called the National Priorities List, which is kind of a list of sites that have significant environmental contamination and or there was not really a what's called a responsible party that the government could go back to hold liable. And so a lot of these sites were just kind of out there with no one to clean them up. And so Congress created a large pot of money to help address those sites, and that was dubbed the Superfund program because of the size of the money that was put into this pot of money. And so Kentucky had, at the time, they identified about 20 sites that were considered Superfund sites, and XEFLATS was one of those. And when this process was occurring, actually back starting in the 80s, the state at the time really did not have adequate expertise and staffing to kind of handle all the federal regulations that came with those designations. So in the mid-90s, the state of Kentucky came to the University of Kentucky and approached the Water Institute about seeing if we could try to help them out. And so what we ultimately did was created a unit of scientists that came to be known as the Federal Facilities Oversight Unit that was housed in Frankfort, worked with the Kentucky Division of Waste Management to try to start dealing with a lot of the regulatory components of that program. And then there's also another component that was called the AIP program that looked at trying to do more scientific research monitoring and so on. So ultimately, we had about 30 employees that we hired that technically were UK employees, but actually work for the state. And so I initially was the associate director of that program. And then the last year of that program, I was the director. So that program actually lasts for 5 years. We basically helped the state get their program up and running, and then the state assimilated a lot of that back into the Division of Waste Management, although we also continued to provide some technical support related to radiological issues at both XEFLATS and then also at the Paducah Gases Diffusion Plant. So that activity continued on into 2000. We then created something called the Kentucky Research Consortium for Energy and Environment. We've got some money through a federal appropriation to try to help provide independent perspectives on issues at both Maxey and more focused down at Paducah, looking at the extensive contamination and cleanup efforts down there.
Okay. After this landed on your desk and you had an opportunity to go to Fleming County and to the site and check it out and assess what was going on there, what sorts of issues did you encounter?
Well, at that time, we were basically, if you look at the overall timeline relative to Maxey, as you know, there were a lot of things that occurred in the 70s, and things were just then starting to kind of be looked at relative to some of the problems. Well, some of them problems already occurred, obviously. The state had kind of taken over the site. So when we got involved, this was shortly after EPA had kind of gotten involved, and they had started to try to start making some initial cleanup efforts. So our involvement then going forward was basically looking at the contractors that were working at the site, looking at what they were proposing to do, making sure that they were doing what they proposed, and then also looking at some of the monitoring data that was coming from the site and so on. So again, we got involved somewhat after EPA had taken over, so to speak, and then was working with them specifically in the initiation of the cleanup process. But what we found was looking at the site from a historical standpoint, obviously there had been a site that ultimately probably had some geologic problems with it that were initially not really fully appreciated. They had some potential pathways for migration of contaminated liquids. The initial designs that were done at the site by the company that was running it had problems with it, which then caused water to basically that got contaminated with different types of nuclear materials, then started kind of migrating into the groundwater, and they then it ended up in a couple of cases in wells that were monitoring at the site, which obviously precipitated ultimately the site being put on the NPL list, but then also noticing that there were some problems with the construction of the trenches that they had used to basically just dump lots of large canisters or drums of material into.
And initially, those trenches were not lined, correct?
That's right. I mean, there's actually some old photographs you can see where they were just dumping basically drums into an open trench, which now we look back on that and it just seems shocking. But back in the 50s and 60s, that was pretty much standard protocol. We had several sites kind of like that. Probably the most notorious in Kentucky was something called Valley of the Drums, which was just south of Louisville. And they just had all these drums just basically all over the place, decaying and so on. Sometimes we forget, if you go back in that period, late 50s, early 60s, there was extreme paranoia in our country about the Soviet Union. So everyone was pretty much focused on, you know, how do we protect ourselves from a nuclear attack? And so what we would look at today is very shoddy potentially, or just, you know, like what were they thinking types of practices. Back then they were kind of preoccupied with what they perceived was more pressing issues, like are we going to get nuked tomorrow or something. I mean,
it's kind of ironic, isn't it? We were in sort of nuking ourselves.
Yeah, that's the paradox. And sometimes, you know, like the cure becomes worse than the disease, right? So
what sorts of problems did you discover concerning the leaching of these materials into groundwater? How extensive was that beyond the site?
Well, it wasn't real extensive, but there was certainly evidence from the wells that there were things that had leached out of the cells. And so there was obviously concern about, well, where is this stuff going? We need to do something. And that precipitated, you know, EPA working out a solution with the state to go in and develop new cells or trenches, get those lined, and then put caps on those, and then put series of monitoring wells around the site, and ultimately they also put up sort of a land buffer to get more protection to the surrounding area. So
did they have to literally move the old stuff from the old trenches into the new trenches?
That's my recollection in some cases, because of the issues with some of the leaching or the lack of liners in some of the cases. And they also went back and did different types of capping on the sites. The old caps, what was happening is water was infiltrating or seeping into these trenches underground, and then that was causing water to accumulate, or the water would become contaminated, and then also that was affecting the caps and causing them to kind of collapse and then provide access of that water to the surface, which then if you had storms could kind of flush that off the site. And so they had tried different strategies. One was trying to take that water and try to evaporate it, and some other things that had some potential problems. So they eventually started to get some good scientific perspectives on the problems and start addressing that in a more scientific and more sound approach.
Did the evaporation process risk sending radioactive material into the air?
Potentially. Of course, it all gets back to what's the concentrations that you're looking at. But that was also something I think that raised concerns from folks as well. So that's why they stopped that process ultimately.
Well, the move to eventually close the site and cap it followed a great deal of activism among local people in Fleming County around the site.
It did.
How do you feel about it today? Can they feel comfortable today that Maxey Flats no longer poses any kind of danger?
I personally feel so. Although if you've been in a situation where you feel like people have not been honest with you, mm-hmm. or that people are just kind of dismissing your concerns or talking down to you, which unfortunately happens a lot of times at sites like this, it's only natural to expect people to be extremely skeptical of not only industry but even government. So I can understand why people would still have some residual considerations, but at least from my perspective as a scientist and an engineer, from what I've seen that has been proposed at the site, it looks like that they've finally got some good solutions in place. And I've been able to work with the people over in Frankfort in the Division of Waste Management for the last 20 years, and I have found them to be extremely conscientious and very concerned about the citizens. I've worked at Paducah as well, and so there you're interfacing with the state, federal EPA, and in that case, Department of Energy, and then other contractors and so on. And just my observations in those types of environments, it's the state of Kentucky folks that have probably had the greatest concerns and pushback on different solutions that might be open to debate about. From that perspective, I feel good that they're keeping an eye on things, and I do know they have a good monitoring network in place now that they're checking things. And again, knowing just the citizens have been mobilized in the past that continue to kind of keep an eye on things, I think that's a good sort of check and balance for the situation.
All right. Dr. Lyndall Ormsby is a professor of civil engineering at the University of Kentucky and associate director of the UK Superfund Basic Research Program. Thanks, Dr. Ormsby.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate the chance to talk with you.
We invited the state officials now responsible for Maxey Flats to an interview, and they instead provided the following written statement. It goes like this. Cabinet Secretary Goodman, Governor Beshear, and Department for Environmental Protection Commissioner Tony Hatton are committed to protecting the safety of all Kentuckians, including during the coronavirus pandemic. Residents who live near Maxey Flats disposal site can be assured that testing being done shows that the site poses no risk to them or to the local environment. The Commonwealth installed an extremely robust cap in 2016, including a significant layer of fill dirt, before final capping even began. Two radiological technicians have walked the entire 55 acres with meters. They found there is no detectable activity on the entire cap. Repeated sampling of surface water and alluvial wells by the 4 full-time employees at the site and processed by an on-site laboratory confirm that the contamination is not spreading. If you would like to know more about MaxiFlats, go to the Facts and Information page on our site, esweku.org. There you will find Dr. Payton's article, the EPA's most recent report on the status of the site, and a MaxiFlats fact sheet provided by the U.S. Department of Energy. Coming up on next week's edition of Eastern Standard, what can we learn from Russia about pandemics?
Pay attention to the scientists and have open communications, even the ones that are telling you what you don't want to listen to.
Hopkinsville Community College history instructor John Davis, author of Russia in the Time of Cholera. And we're very pleased to introduce another new series here on Eastern Standard, Future Tense, an interview segment that will be hosted by anthropologist and author Chris Begley. The focus is on our future in a post-pandemic world.
You know, when I study how people and how societies have changed in the past, one of the things that comes up over and over again is this amazing resilience.
Chris Begley will be exploring the near future with artists, academics, activists, politicians, and others to help us get a sense of where we are, where we're going, and what we've learned, and what that means. His first guest, the award-winning writer and multidisciplinary artist, Bianca Spriggs.
I'm hoping that this sort of competitiveness that Americans are so prone to, kind of like colonialist mindset we've all inherited, that pull yourself up by your bootstraps and there is shame in asking for help and there's something wrong with you if you don't have something to show for yourself. I'm really hoping that we're done with that.
Future Tense with Chris Begley begins next week on Eastern Standard. And a program note, I goofed. I mentioned last week that we would include in this edition a look at how the pandemic is upending life at the Appalachian Center for the Arts in Pikeville. But trying to stuff 10 pounds into a 5-pound bag doesn't always work. And indeed, we ran out of time in this edition, so we'll feature that interview next week. Promise, for sure. That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.